Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to New Books in Art, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Tanya Tuller, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Amanda Phillips about her book, Sea Change, Ottoman Textiles Between the Mediterranean and the Indian Ocean. Amanda, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tanya. Thank you for having me.
Okay, so before we start talking about your lovely book, would you please tell us a little bit about yourself and how did this book come to life?
Sure. So Tanya and I, of course, we've already talked a little bit. Maybe a few listeners know I'm American. Perhaps you can tell by my accent. And I started college with a real interest in art history that I was lucky enough to have from high school. And so after some intervening years, after living in Paris, in Tunisia, in Turkey, and elsewhere, this interest in textiles, I don't know if it culminated or sort of started again with my doctoral dissertation at Oxford. And this, I really wanted to look at silk textiles, and I identified a real particular type of silk textile, a kind of velvet made in the Ottoman Empire. And this kind of velvet is a cushion cover. And I don't think anyone could believe that somebody was going to write a dissertation about cushion covers, but there you have it. So that was, you know, 5 long years of research on upholstery, basically. But it turned out that this was sort of a great way to talk about social and economic history. It was a great way to talk about technology. It's a great way to talk about the objects themselves. They are beautiful, the best of them. But then when I sort of thought about turning this into a book, first of all, I'm not sure I could have found a publisher willing to take on cushion covers entirely. But it also became so clear to me that I couldn't talk about these without talking about other kinds of textiles. And that's because, you know, for these complicated things like a velvet, we'll talk about, you know, lampas or damask later, the technology is huge. The types of different materials are large in number. The numbers of people working on them, also colossal. So when we think about these big landscapes, these big groups of sort of artisans, we think about silk coming from one place, gold from somewhere else, and then we think about the people consuming or purchasing these velvets or other cloths, we sort of have to do a big rethinking. And the big rethinking just makes everything bigger. What I mean by this is, I think, you know, we sit here as art historians and we're interested in luxury textiles, we're interested in things with motifs or decoration. But when we think about the way people use things, that's really just the tip of the iceberg. And we leave stuff out, such as plain, but really sumptuous and expensive silk, or wool and mohair, which could be just as expensive and, again, just as luxurious as a silk. So with this sort of expanded landscape, I began to think not only of materials and consumers, but of actual geography. So the story between Ottoman silk and Italy, especially, I think it has been so well told in the past, say, 25 years. But there's quite a lot to say, too, about the Ottoman relationship with Iran, Syria, Iraq, and India as well. The Red Sea trade, the overland trade, and the fact that these textiles were arriving in huge volume in the Ottoman capital of Istanbul, as elsewhere. So thinking about that, thinking about all of these things, you know, it got me into the book. I wanted to tell a big history, and I have to admit something here. It took me well into the writing of this book to think through what makes textiles different, right? Again, here we are, we're art historians mostly, and here we are in a podcast too, right? You can't actually see the stuff, but art historians, we're so visual, right? We're always looking at look, basically, but textiles really are maybe chiefly interesting for their other properties, right? They're heavy, they're light, they're scratchy, they're soft, they're stiff, they're supple. And they can be made in any number of ways, used in any number of other ways. So thinking about textiles as this unique category really sort of got me going. And I'm going to leave it there, but also say too, in the past, I would say 10 or 15 years, things have also changed so much in terms of the accessibility of collections. And I have really profited from that. Just by sheer happenstance. So much is now online that I can track down. So much is open to researchers, but the way things weren't historically. So all of these things together, there you go.
Perfect. So basically a proper journey of the book as the journey of the textiles as well. So if we start at the beginning, I mean, you do get quite technical about the production as well, which is something that we tend to see more and more now in art historical practices as well, so that we don't just look at the object and describe the object, but we are also exploring deep down in how the object has been produced and where the differences in these productions are. So at the beginning, in your first chapter, if we start there, you lead the reader on a journey of silk weaving. Marco Polo mentions silk production in Turkic lands, and your discussion starts with this beautiful photograph of fragments of a garment that was made for the Seljuk ruler, Sultan Alaaddin Kaykubat. And there are one of the beginnings of silk production in Anatolia before Ottoman rulers gained the power in the area. Yet silk production is rather complex enterprise. And as we learn in your book, quite intensely, that it's not so easy to get to the end product. Could you explain to us what it involves and why it is so precarious?
Sure. And right. So again, we're mentioning this thing that neither of us can see right now. This silk that was made for the Seljuk ruler, Alaaddin Kaykubat, is amazing. It's a unicum, so it's the only thing like it. So it's crimson, it's gold, it's sort of unusual in its motifs. It has these stacks of medallions with pairs of tigers that are back to back, but they also sort of turn their heads to snarl at each other. And it's also quite interesting because it has a name on it, which allows it to date it quite tightly, right, to the 1220s or so. And then at some point, you know, it is a textile. It was made for this man, presumably, but it got cut up and turned into a liturgical garment, right? And so this is, you know, textiles are transforming. So knowing that about the object, we can also talk a little bit about, yeah, this whole point you just totally correctly made about complexity here. So this is a kind of textile. It's what's called a compound weave in a general sense, and a samite in a more sort of narrow category. And samite was a textile structure, almost always silk, woven in Byzantium in Italy, but also Syria, Iran, and Iraq, you know, really until around 1000 or 1200. This is a little bit of an outlier. So samite, this compound weave, is made on a giant draw loom that's also equipped with a patterning harness. And this is a device that allows for swift, mechanized repetition of motif, exact repetition. So that's a huge advantage. But it took some setting up. It had to be programmed ahead by a designer who understood exactly the unders and the overs of the warps and wefts that would eventually result in these repeating motifs. So you can tell already it's a big machine. It required intense expertise for the pre-programming, then also some expertise in setting up, so mounting that device, threading the loom as well. And then in terms of the weaving, it took two different people, a weaver and what we often call a drawboy or an assistant. They were each in charge of one set of warps. And so that's actually sort of the most basic part. And then you think about all the people growing the silk and reeling the silk and dyeing the silk. If you want to take it further back, my colleagues point us out, mining the gold, making that thread as well. So these are a lot of different inputs requiring many types of different expertise. So lose one of those, there's your complexity. It all kind of falls apart. And I would say too, I'm going to pause here and go back to some complexity and precarity too. And we think about that date in particular for the Kaikoubad silk, right? That's 1220s. And this is a very precarious moment in Anatolia, right? So what's now Turkey? There's the Latin occupation of Constantinople, right? Byzantium had been briefly defeated. We also have the sort of beginnings of the breakdown of the Armenian kingdoms in Cilicia, sort of what we think of sort of now as northern Syria or Mesopotamia. We have incredible movement of people around, forced migration and otherwise, and a lot of sort of, you know, shifting power. So how does a center that's making such a complex object survive these kinds of changes? You know, it's very much an open question. And then on the other hand, who has, Sultan or otherwise, the ability to commission an object like this from some center that does appear to sustain or be resilient enough to make it? And I'm going to add one more thing here too, is that the Kaikoubad silk, and I have not analyzed this, so I'm relying on the work of my colleague Susan Day at the Textile Museum in Lyon. She noticed that this is a samite on one hand, but it uses gold thread on an animal substrate. So what that is either gut or leather that's been gilded or used some sort of paste to get your gold on there. And this is something that's really found in Central Asia or Eastern Iran. So it's a weave structure used in West Asia, but a material more commonly found in Central Asia. So this is a quite interesting point. And it also sort of lets us see this much more expanded landscape.
Yeah, that's fascinating, because we sometimes try and figure out where the material comes from, but we sometimes don't have this knowledge where the actual skill comes from. Maybe that's why these textiles are so fascinating to study, something that we might not fully acknowledge in terms of not having that kind of output in, let's say, ceramics or glass, for example. So in if we're following further on that journey, you are leading us towards a sort of a center of production and a formation of center of production in Bursa. Would you be able to tell us a little bit more about it?
So, yes, just to speak a little bit about Bursa, which we have pretty good evidence for in the Ottoman Long Durée was a major center for silk weaving. So it's also an early Ottoman capital. The sultans did some early mosque building there starting in the 1330s. If not earlier, the city was conquered in 1326. And the earliest evidence for silk weaving there, in fact, comes from a Bavarian prisoner of war who mentions silks being sold in the marketplace, which of course is not evidence for weaving. But he actually, as a prisoner of war, makes his way to Iran, where he does then comment that reeled silk or silk filament that's grown in Iran is sent to Bursa for weaving. So there we have some pretty clear evidence. What we don't have at this point is a ton of objects, and I'll get to that in a minute. In terms of Bursa, it does seem like before the Ottomans, there was not a tradition of silk weaving there. Other kinds of weaving, yes, perhaps. Remember, too, the circumstances of the Byzantine Empire, circa 1300 or so. Silk weaving there had also fallen into desuetude. But other kinds of weaving, maybe. And to think of this expanded landscape where certain kinds of cotton or linen weaving may create at least a baseline of expertise for silk weaving is one thing. But then on the other hand, what the Ottoman sultans were doing in this period, sort of from the 1330s or so, were creating secure marketplaces. And they also made Bursa a customs point so that the silk filament coming along the Silk Road from Iran at this point was taxed in Bursa. We understand from other centers, perhaps, or other parts of history that silk weaving often follows silk filament. So as we stretch from east to west, the filament comes first, the expertise in weaving comes second. So perhaps this is how it started in Bursa. However, for those really fancy silks we're talking about, it almost certainly would have required bringing artisans, one does not stumble into this technology, and sponsoring a workshop. So did merchants perhaps see an opportunity? Did an Ottoman sultan at some point see an opportunity as well? So Bursa continues to grow. 1330s, we have an Ottoman civil war at the very beginning of the 15th century. But by the 1460s, we have more evidence here from archival sources that state looms were being bought and sold in Bursa. And from there, much more evidence and some relatively securely dated textiles that seem to have come from there as well.
So you've already mentioned some of these materials preserved in churches, and one specific case study that you first presented in your book is the Studenica silk with an inscription naming Sultan Bayezid. It seems like a very unique detective story, this uncovering of the unknown or at least little known silk from otherwise famous Studenica monastery. I mean, I have to admit, as a undergraduate student at the University of Ljubljana, we had a special course just on frescoes of, different monasteries and churches of Serbia, and Studenica was one of these beautiful prime examples, but nobody ever mentioned any textiles. So how did you come across this object, and what is so significant about it?
Right. So I think in some, it is a significant object for me, but in other ways, I mean, you make a point, it pales in significance to how famous Studenica Monastery in sort of south central Serbia is for its other art. So namely, its incredible cycle of frescoes, and then also sort of the church architecture of the cathedral as well. Just so super important. And maybe, you know, in all fairness, they kind of overshadow the textile. So, I mean, part of the answer there, too, is that this silk, which, of course, is the Olivera silk, as it's known in the monastic community, is pretty well known there, right? And it's really famous because it's connected to the wife of Sultan Bayezid I, that's Princess Mileva Oliveira, who is said to have brought it to Studenica. It's also known in the community there as it was possibly used as a cenotaph cover for the Serbian king Stefan Nemanja, and this is very important. And it's pretty well published in Serbia. There's a catalog from the treasury at Studenica where there's color photos, and a Yugoslav scholar also published it in a journal in the mid-20th century, including translating the inscriptions. So this incredible textile came into English language literature sort of in the mid-later 20th century because of really contact among Byzantinists more than anything. And it made it into sort of the Islamic art history world in a short article by Richie Ettinghausen, I think it was 1969. So there it was, sort of hiding in plain sight. It gets picked up in another big book, sort of the really big famous book on Ottoman textiles called Ipek, but I don't think they had a chance to see or analyze it, or at least to get a good photo, but it's that book that allowed me to find it and then follow up. So yeah, I mean, I want to say something about this quickly, right? Again, I'm talking about this massive, incredible hanging, and of course we can't see it. So it's the earliest surviving Ottoman textile that we know about, I think, bar none. It's one of the first extant pieces of Ottoman art, bar none. I mean, setting aside architecture. That said, though, you know, it's a unicum. So what it is, it's, you know, it's massive, first of all. It's 2 by 3 meters. Which makes it much bigger than anything we have from the Ottoman Empire otherwise. In addition, it has these bands with different patterns, you know, sort of alternating, and a repeating inscription that wishes Bayezid glorious victories. Nothing like that else, right? And so from this, we know the date, that's circa 1400. Again, and so it's a unicum. It means we have a gap before and also a gap afterward. It's about another 60 odd years before we get the next textiles we can maybe attribute to the Ottoman Empire. It's also, by the way, you know, thinking outside the Ottoman Empire box, really one of the very few things that survives intact from the years around 1400. It is amazing. It is preserved the way I think it was made, right down to the end tassels. So this is also extraordinary, and it is worth more study than I have done. And I hope going forward, we'll be doing some more work with the community there and with the abbot and with the patriarch, who've been also extraordinarily generous in granting me access to this object and working with my colleagues as well. So I feel incredibly privileged to have had this opportunity. Mm-hmm.
So we have talked about this beautiful silks, but sort of late 15th, 16th century see also the rise of Damascus and lampas and velvets. So would different type of textiles indicate different use and different types of garments?
So the short answer here is no. Textiles do not always have a one-to-one correspondence with garments. But of course, right, I'm an academic, so I'm going to expand on this a little bit. So one of the ones we talk about is something called saraser. That's an Ottoman word. It's like a cloth of gold, more or less. So a ton of metal thread. And these do seem to be really associated with robes of honor, especially as we get into the 1700s or so. But in other cases, you know, textiles, again, it's a funny medium. They're pretty able to transform depending on what you need them to do. So we talk about saraser for robes of honor or hilat, but I have read in archival sources that eventually people maybe cut up their robes of honor and turn them into pillows. So I've seen something referred to as a robe of honor pillow. I don't know quite what to make of that. There's also clear examples, well published, of liturgical garments for the Greek or Russian Orthodox churches, also for the Catholic Church in Italy, garments made out of cut up cushion covers, which are quite easy to identify. There's a pair of amazing kaftans at the Topkapı Saray Museum that were made of what were probably initially curtains. So there is a great deal of flexibility, but I think probably in the 1700s or so, we see a growing divide in the some kinds of fabrics, meaning those used for upholstery versus those used for clothing. And this is because, in part, for some clothing at least, there's a rise in lightweight materials, right? Made of a mix of silk and cotton, meant to be softer, easier to touch, and better for garments as well. So not stiff, not bulky, not suitable for upholstery. So there is a slight divide at some points. But again, I think it's not as clear that we sitting here in 2022 would expect.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Right. If I just may add on to this, you do explain beautifully different type of garments and how they are made. But what I found interesting and surprising to some end was the velvets and the complexity that goes into producing velvet textiles. Would you be able to elaborate a little bit on what kind of technology is involved? And also, why were the velvets popular, particularly in crimson color? Or maybe that's just my impression.
I think it's a completely correct impression, too. You know, if you sort of flip through a book of Ottoman textiles, you see a lot of crimson velvet. So I'll answer that first, just for the fun of it. And I don't have a great answer for this. I think you will know maybe some other people have sort of would notice a shift. We think of purple, at least in sort of West Asia and the Mediterranean, as the royal color, right? Something coming from the Romans through Byzantium as well, absolutely. But by the time we get to the Ottomans, we'd had the sort of intervening disruption of the Mongol invasions of West Asia. And they seem to bring with them from Central Asia or from China, really a taste for crimson. And so it's crimson that gets used over and over again by the Ottomans, but by other polities, the Italians, most notably in this period as well. It's the sort of 14th, 15th, 16th century. And the crimson, usually for the Ottomans, it was made out of a kind of bug, right? Rather unpleasant looking little bug. But they could also use combinations too of madder, so a sort of dye root. And in some cases too, counterfeit dye or uncolor fast dye that was coming from a tropical hardwood. Again, this is well attested in both archival sources and in the extant textiles themselves. So a lot of ways to get your scarlet or your crimson in this period, some better than others. For velvets in particular, that crimson absolutely does seem to kind of stick with them more than other types of fabrics. And again, I'm not entirely sure why. The crimson ones do survive. Archival sources do mention other colors, but impression again, overwhelmingly crimson. So velvet, and here we're talking really about silk velvet. There are some other kinds out there. What we're talking about is a kind of fabric with little tufts that give it this characteristic pile, right? That plush surface that really defines velvet. In terms of the origin of this structure, nobody's quite sure. Michael Peter of the Abegg Stiftung has suggested, I think, North China, circa 1100, maybe earlier. So by the time we get to the Ottomans and, you know, the 1400s, velvet's been made in Italy and Iran and Central Asia for some centuries. And when we talk about velvet, you know, for the Ottomans, as elsewhere, there are a couple of types. So there's the solid pile plush in a single color, right? There's also solid pattern, solid pile with a pattern as well. So, you know, whether it's tulips or medallions or what have you. And then there's something called voided and brocaded velvet, where you get, you know, bits of it or parts of a motif with this kind of pile. But then also it, the empty areas with no pile are infilled with an extra metal thread. So it makes this incredible contrast between these lush, plush crimson areas and this sort of glittering gold. So already you can tell that this is expensive and it's complicated. Velvet in all cases that we've talked about require a second set of warps. So a second beam on the loom or a separate weighting system if it has pattern. And also we think about it, you know, velvet is kind of 3D, right? All of those little tufts, it turns out they take a ton of silk to make. So it's material intensive. It takes about 8 times the amount, the length of silk you would have for sort of a regular flat textile to get you all those little loops or tufts. So there is a luxury textile. In terms of making, how does this work? Depends on exactly the type, but this is work that's done by the weaver as she, or usually he, is passing the weft. And it involves pulling little loops over a rod or wire and then letting them fall back down. So you create the loop and then using a knife, often using a knife, to cut it as well. So it requires a couple of extra steps, as well as all this extra material. The ones where with patterns are made on these giant looms with pattern harnesses, so requiring the kind of pre-programming and setup ahead of time as well. So a very complicated fabric in terms of technology and also in terms of materials. You know, that plush, it only looks good if your thread is of great quality as well.
Yeah, fascinating. Every time I mean, we'll talk hopefully further down more about the tactile part of the textiles, but plush is one that I always need to touch. It's somehow you are drawn towards it to touch that silkiness, if I may use that word, element of it. But one other bit that was really interesting to read was that one group of people that had special garments produced were Janissaries. And these were soldiers. They were usually boys who were kidnapped or recruited from Christian lands and then educated and became part of the Ottoman army. And you mentioned that they wore waterproof garments. Would you be able to explain a little bit more about that?
Yeah, sure. But right, we can't also abandon our Janissaries, right? So our elite Ottoman guard, such a great story. So this is sort of a standing army, which is pretty unusual in the period. And they get, again, unusually, right, sort of quasi-uniforms that distinguish them, right? So these are embellished with gold thread. They're complemented by these incredible, tall, white, cylindrical hats, known as burk, that really set them apart from other parts of the Ottoman army, certainly from the Ottoman populace, right? And it's also interesting, in the 16th century, the wool used for these costumes was made in and around the city of Salonika. This is a monopoly that's controlled at that point by Ottoman Jewish subjects who had fled the Iberian Peninsula during the final years of the Reconquista and had been welcomed or at least tolerated in Salonika and elsewhere. And so the Sultan gave them a special license to weave these specific woolens for the Janissaries. And So that's quite interesting, and it gives us actually a sense of part of the waterproofing process. So let me back up a little bit. So we're talking about wool, for instance, and wool is an animal fiber. It's already somewhat waterproof if it's tightly woven, unlike, say, cotton. But there are additional ways to make it more waterproof. And the first of these is fulling it. So take a woven textile or a woven woolen, raise a nap by combing or brushing, so raise little fibers, and then beat it to recompact these fibers. The scales on a piece of fiber of wool catch at each other and they sort of mat. And what we think some of these Ottoman Jewish subjects had brought with them from Iberia is a kind of fulling mill that used a trip hammer to really compact those fibers and help make them more waterproof. Another way to do this, of course, is to grease the wool. So take the fabric and give it sort of a oily coating that would help again to repel the water. And, you know, the soldiers got waterproof garments, and so did really anyone who could afford them as well. Certainly maybe different ones, but our archival sources attest to rain cloaks, certainly. And some of these could be quite nice. Wool could be very expensive as well.
Well, throughout the book, you also mention the trade contacts. They weave a special undercurrent of these influences in both technology and motif transfer. I think here, obviously, about Italy mainly, cities such as Venice, Lucca, Pisa, which we know were textile enterprises, so to speak. And they produced their own textiles that were very similar to Ottoman ones. It seems I always look at it as a race for dominance over the innovation, over the industry, and also the economic gain that comes through that. But were there also positive takeaways? And if at all, how can they be seen in Ottoman textiles?
It is very much a give and take relationship between the Ottomans and their counterparts. And really, I'll talk about Venice here because I have kind of better information about it. I'll leave aside Genoa and Florence or Pisa or Lucca a little bit. It's sort of, it's give and take. It's also a push and pull in some ways. So when we talk about a race for dominance or competition, I think that that's a good way to put it. And there's quite a bit of push-pull, maybe chicken and egg, when it comes to similarities between Italian and Ottoman textiles. And when I think of this, I really think of velvets, right, in terms of them looking very much alike. It's a little less clear maybe for that cloth of gold or for the kinds of multicolored flowered textiles we get in the 16th century for the Ottomans. So to talk about a rivalry or a rush for dominance, right, we do know a good deal about Italy, about Venice in particular, from the work of Luca Mola, among others, and how weavers in that city really tried and working with the city to keep certain technologies proprietary, right, to preserve monopolies on certain kinds of silk weaving. By contrast, though, the Ottoman, his ministers, the mindset seems to be different. So rivalry in terms of either large or really high quality production of silk textiles is not a concern for them. Instead, the focus is on providing excellent silk textiles and other textiles and other goods to Ottoman subjects. So there's the push-pull. They were delighted that the Venetians, among others, were weaving all this great stuff that they could end up purchasing. So this Ottoman economic mindset, sometimes called provisionist, right? It's about ensuring abundance, the well-being of your subjects, make sure there were great stuff available at fair prices. So the Ottomans were delighted. Now I say the Ottomans, that's kind of large, but the Ottoman Sultan, his ministers, the market inspectors were glad to have all of these high quality and really frankly very beautiful things coming from Venice or wherever else as well.
So you were, if we are progressing through the book, in your chapter 4, you're talking a lot about the labor, the training, the people who worked in this workshops. Could we talk about an organized group of people in a sense of contemporary guilds in the Western world, that they would have their own rules, their regulated prices, set of designs, or we're having a completely different structure?
That's a great question. And there's been a certain amount of discussion about whether we should, you know, think of these as guilds with all that term incorporates for Europe. So organized groups of artisans with a clear hierarchical structure that come together in part to defend their own interests, but then also to sort of, I don't know, set rules among themselves. So Ottoman historians who've worked on this say there are things shared in common between these European ones and the Ottomans. But part of the problem for the Ottomans, so this is for silk weaving, among other things, is we tend to only have snapshots of what they're up to. This is because they don't seem to generate documents on their own terms, but only when they brush up against some sort of administrative or legal structure that creates the kind of source that discusses them. So when we think of these groups of artisans, and we read court cases mostly, legal proceedings brought to the Sharia court of the Ottoman Empire, what we're seeing is only sort of a little bit of what's going on. So these cases, certainly, they're arguments about price. They're arguments about the quality of materials. They're sometimes arguments about the length of apprenticeship or day laborers leaving looms when they've agreed to work more. So they give you a sense of a group of people. Sometimes they name a guild elder. We could think of that sort of as a headman. We have apprentices, journeymen as well. What we don't have is a sense that this remained static or constant. People have argued, I think probably correctly, that these groups were kind of fluid. They came together as necessary to, again, defend their interests as need be against outsiders, against the central authorities, against interlopers of one sort or another, but they did not necessarily sort of year on year maintain this necessarily.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, actually, in this, in a very fast-moving environment, also politically in that area, I would say. Well, my name is Tanya Tuller, and I'm talking to Amanda Phillips about her new book, Sea Change, Ottoman Textiles Between the Mediterranean and the Indian Ocean. And if we are looking towards the end of your book, you are talking about next stage, new centuries, 16th to 18th century production. How did this production and the consumption of Ottoman silks and by default velvets and damask change in those centuries?
Some things definitely change, and we can track this certainly through extant objects, which we attribute based, you know, on sort of stylistic evidence to one period or another. Other evidence for change comes from archival sources. So way back when I was doing my doctoral research, I noticed that certain kinds of these really heavy, beautiful luxury weaves seem to be present less often in estate inventories from sort of the late 1600s and 1700s. In the 1700s in particular, there's a really steep fall off in listings for different kinds of velvet. Those cushion covers, man, they remain constant, but it looks like people have less, maybe less is being produced of the other sorts. So then the question is what's driving this? Is it a problem in production, or is it a shift in consumption? Did an Ottoman consumer, so these people whose estate inventories we are reading, did they want something else, or is it just that other things were available to them, new things? So production, consumption. other archival sources give us the names of what seem to be new types of textiles coming in again in the sort of 1650s into the 1700s. One of the names of these fabrics is kitai, or Cathay, or China. And it certainly wasn't from China. It was a type of textile that could be imported from Syria, from India, from Iran. It's a ghost textile. I'm not exactly sure what it looked like, but it seems to appear in greater numbers. Was it some sort of chinoiserie? At the same time, there is an increase in the amount of a fabric called garamassud, which seems to maybe be coming from South Asia, and then an Ottoman imitation of that as well. So some people might want to call this import substitution, right? You start making your own local version of a more expensive imported type. Now, we do not have these in surviving examples, at least not that we know of. Part of the problem with material culture studies is making a link between what your archival source tells you and the actual type of object it describes. So here we're a little bit out of luck. We do have other types of evidence, certainly, for changes in textiles. So for instance, if we look at manuscript painting or costume books, they seem to represent slightly different types than we've seen before. And certainly the visual or extant evidence is compelling. However, there's also things that stay the same. So robes of honor mentioned earlier, still made out of that cloth of gold or silver. Also, the hangings made for the shrines at Mecca and Medina, these remain constant. So this is a fairly unchanging 400 years of making these hangings. And even with the introduction of jacquard head looms, so fully automated looms, these hangings remained from the 1850s into the 1920s pretty constant. So, you know, fashion, trade, the interwoven globe on one hand, but then things that remain purposefully purposely conservative, or appropriately conservative.
Well, all the chapters of the book are prefaced by Turkish proverbs, which I really enjoyed. And one reads, "With patience, the cocoon of the mulberry leaf is made into a silk dress." So I hope our listeners who have patiently followed our conversation have built enough interest in the topic to pick up the book and read further about the complex and varied textile production in Ottoman lands. The book, I have to mention, also provides really comprehensive glossary, a list of bibliography, and a large number of beautiful colored photographs, which we cannot really share because we're here on a podcast, but worth to check them out. One only wish to be able to also touch these garments, and I loved how you discussed this tactile element of garments as well, how they wrap around the human body to protect, to elaborate, to elevate. So do you think art history should pay closer attention to this tactile role of an object across all material culture?
The obvious answer is yes. I absolutely do. In some ways, right? I commented, at the very beginning, how lucky we all are that we can see things online now, that collections are digitized, so we can do our detective work diligently and easily. But in other ways, I think we're robbed of something if that's the only thing we do. We don't have a sense of scale. We don't have a sense of texture, certainly, or the glitter and shine even of some of these things. And I would extend that certainly to ceramics, the way we hold things. If we want to talk tactile, we could also talk haptic, right? Really reaching out, touching, pulling on a handle or something. And even for arts of the book, most of us see things, how do I want to say this, vertically on the wall or on the screen. But a book is meant to be held at a desk or on a lap. It's something completely different. Pages are meant to be sort of pulled and touched. And I do think art history really has come around to this, whether that translates into sort of our everyday experience and really thinking through this more carefully. I hope the results will be good in the next decade or so.
Yes, so do I, because I also work with material culture, and I have this innate drive every time to touch things and learn through the touch. I think there's so much to learn through just that bit.
And you know, this is something, and I don't know how successfully I brought this out, this is something an Ottoman consumer or any sort of consumer in these centuries would understand. You don't understand a textile by looking at it. You are urged to touch the textile. This is how you understand quality and make sure you are not getting a bad bargain for your hard-earned coin. So how heavy is it? How likely is it to withstand wear? You know by touching, not by seeing.
Yeah, that's a wonderful point. Thank you, Amanda. We've taken a lot of your time, and thank you so much for sharing your expertise with us. But to close our conversation, I have one last question, because I'm a nosy client. I really want to know, if you could get one garment made by the Ottoman textile craftsman, what would you select to have made for you?
Oh, I don't know if it's a garment, but wrap me up in one of those mohair blankets, right? Absolutely. I mean, I would look, I don't know, I'd look what the Ottoman commentaries called an uncouth bear, but it would be totally worth it, I think, for the softness and the warmth of that goat hair. So yeah, just great stuff. And again, tactile.
Absolutely. Sounds very, very nice, very delightful, I must say. Just before we close, would you mind sharing, are you working on something textile related for your next research project, or you're walking away from textiles for a bit?
No, I will never go too far from textiles. It's also partly my training, right? So I will stick this for a while. Right now, I'm working with a colleague on a very small article. I'll talk about that quickly, about a technology for terry cloth, which is actually really similar to the technology for velvet. So what we come to know as Turkish toweling, terry, whatever, it seems to be a structure that originates in the Ottoman Empire. And then we talked about the Industrial Revolution, Tanya and I, a little earlier, gets translated to the Manchester context in about 1850. So that's my little sort of foray into transnational textiles in the modern period, actually.
Well, Amanda, that sounds like a great project. I want to thank you for being on the show today. I really enjoyed your book. So again, Amanda Phillips' book, Sea Change, Ottoman Textiles Between the Mediterranean and the Indian Ocean, is out now. And thank you for today, and take care.
Thank you. My pleasure.